The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation about what the church is doing in the world. And it's a conversation in which we talk about a variety of things that hopefully make our world more just and make it more compassionate. So, Fanny, we've kind of gotten into non-summer, right?
Unfortunately,
non-summer. So, how was your weekend?
It was pretty good. It was quiet.
Yeah?
Yeah, I just spent some time with friends.
You just chilled out?
Yeah, chilled out.
So we got a lot of things we got to talk about this week.
Yeah.
Because some of our quote-unquote celebrity friends have been making a little bit of news.
A lot of things happened.
Yeah, so kind of Serena, not so good in terms of winning, and very unemotional about it, right?
Yeah, very unemotional. No emotion at all.
Okay. And then... We got a little bit of a cat fight, right?
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, between our Bronx,
Bronx and Queens.
Bronx and is Nicki Minaj from Queens?
Jamaica.
Really?
Yeah.
So not the Jamaica in the island.
No,
the Jamaica by the subway.
Yeah, she's actually from Trinidad and Tobago.
Ah.
Yeah.
But where was she born? She was born there.
I believe she was born in Queens.
Born in Queens.
Yeah.
And Cardi?
Bronx.
Bronx. So I got to go with the Bronx kid.
Me too.
I'm from the Bronx. So that's, I don't want to know the facts. I'm just in favor of the Bronx
same.
Kid. Same thing. Doesn't make any difference. You know, so anyway, so we got to talk about that. And we got a few other things we need to talk about. But this is, you know, this past week, we had the anniversary of September 11th, and September 11th is a day that really changed a lot of things in the world. And I'm not one of those people who thinks that, you know, everything is historic, everything is iconic. Actually, if I could ban a word in the world, I'd ban the word iconic. I mean, it's just one of those dumb words that is used to all over the place. But anyway, but the world has changed after 9/11. And again, the other, you know, I think silly phrase that people talked about was well, if we have to change the way we live, then they have won. Now, whatever that means, it and there was a plea to go on doing our life as usual. Well, the reality is that the world has changed. And if those of us who live in cities, those of us who live in New York, are very, very much aware that the world has changed. Because even when we come in here to our studio, the reality is that we now have to do security that we never had to do. We have to kind of show identification, or we have to get a security card. So the world has changed. And, you know, some of that has changed probably not for the good. A lot of it has not changed for the good. Some of it is just a necessary way that we do business these days. And one of the things, though, that is intriguing about 9/11 is a couple of things. One, positively, it has forced a kind of a little bit of a focus on volunteerism. It's focused where people have said, well, it was such a bad day and such awful things. There were a lot of death. So let's commemorate it by doing a lot of good stuff and people volunteering. So, you know, a lot of people organize volunteer stuff. The other side of it, and this is, we're going to speak with our first guest in a little while, Kathy O'Callaghan, who's the president and founder of Hearts and Homes for Refugees in a place just outside of New York City. One of the things we realize is that as a result of 9/11, we now take a very different view of immigrants and refugees from certain parts of the country, certain parts of the world, and parts of the world in which those who were involved in the 9/11 attack came from. And so without a lot of discrimination and without a lot of nuances, we kind of tend to paint things with a pretty broad brush. And so the world has changed in the way that we view refugees and immigrants. after 9/11. Sometimes up, sometimes down, but there's a real rhetoric that kind of ties 9/11, those who did that, the country they're from, with all people from a particular part of the world and or of particular religions. And that's a situation which we're living with today. So that's part of what we're dealing with after 9/11. So let's go to our first guest. And I'm delighted that Kathy O'Callaghan, the president and founder of Hearts and Homes for Refugees, has come into the studio to join us today on Just Love. Kathy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I listened to you talk, and how'd you manage to disguise that Louisville accent?
It's early in the morning. Oh. I haven't had a drink.
Oh.
And I live around a lot of New Yorkers who point it out when it does manifest.
Okay. All right. So tell me, you began in Kentucky. How'd you wind your way up to New York?
Life. I lived, went to school in New Orleans, worked in Washington, D.C., married a man who became, went into the finance world, and my firm was in New York City, so I worked there, and it worked out, and my father actually was from Mamaroneck, New York.
Ah, so you had ties to New York anyway. Well, we're certainly glad that you came to New York, and, you know, one of the things they often talk about, carpetbaggers, well, we welcome people in New York from all parts of the country, all parts of the world. I mean, I don't know how many people are native-born New Yorkers, but it doesn't make a difference. If you come and you want to kind of hang out here, you want to get a job here, you want to make some money here, that's good. You want to be a good neighbor, you're welcome. So, Kathy, thanks so much for joining us in New York, even though now you're welcoming others because you've been here so long. So thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me in New York.
So now tell us about this Hearts and Homes for Refugees.
Hearts and Homes for Refugees is a grassroots organization that was born out of an idea about 2 to 3 years ago when we all, like so many people, witnessed the refugee crisis on the front pages of the paper. And I was not alone. There were many people in our communities in Westchester who felt the need to do something. And what I saw, along with everyone else, is that there was a gaping hole. There was nothing being done. And it was a clear path to being able to do something. I really felt that there was a way to act and to make meaningful contributions. And so got a task force, found like-minded people, and we came up with a mission to welcome refugees one family at a time and to encourage, inspire, educate, and motivate others to do the same. And that's what we've been working on for about 3 years.
So how exactly do you... How do you do it? What are some of the really concrete things that you do to welcome refugees?
First, we gather, convene people and collaborate and have discourse, conversation, and we talk to Catholic Charities and HIAS into coming to Westchester County because they are the resettlement agencies that do such good work in resettlement. And with their presence, we were able to create community models of co-sponsorship and welcoming refugees that way, so that volunteers, communities can give their time and money to supporting refugees beyond the normal direct resettlement of 3 months and help integrate and assimilate refugees into our own communities.
So again, in an ordinary world, we kind of think people come from other countries there and they resettle in the United States, immigrants, refugees. Sometimes I think we probably don't make a distinction between immigrants and refugees. Can you kind of help our listeners understand, again, we've talked about it before, but there is kind of a technical difference between a migrant coming to this country who is a refugee and one who is an immigrant. So give our listeners a little bit of a 101 on the difference between immigrants and refugees.
So a refugee is an immigrant. Immigrants describes a broad population of individuals who come here for various reasons. Refugees and asylees come to this country for fear of persecution and fear for their lives. And refugees are identified as refugees when outside the country they are processed. And asylees or asylum seekers come to this country and then claim status as fearing their lives or persecution. So refugees and asylees both are part of the immigrant population.
And your group focuses particularly on refugees.
Yes.
And so tell us, over the past few years, you live in an area just outside of New York City, Westchester, Lower Hudson Valley. How many refugees have been resettled in that area, in your area?
So we're probably talking about 60, little maybe more, 60, right. 70 refugees between the two resettlement agencies.
And that would be, and what would that be? Maybe about 20 families
something
or so?
Something like that. Yeah. There have been individuals, but most of the cases are families.
Okay. And I assume they've come from many different countries?
They have. Middle Eastern countries, Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Congo, there are Venezuelans, so a variety. You know, we think of refugees as the Middle East, Syrians, et cetera, but actually there have been millions and millions of refugees, way more than the Syrian refugees that we are seeing today.
At the current time, and again, as you mentioned, it's also my understanding, and I think this is helpful for our listeners to know, that at least my understanding is a refugee who comes into the United States kind of gets a double vetting, that they are, first of all, they're kind of declared as meeting the criteria for being a refugee. And as Kathy mentioned, that criteria is that in the country that they're fleeing, there is a really deep fear of them being persecuted, maybe killed, were they to go back. So literally, they're given refuge outside of their own country so they don't get killed if they were forced to go back. So first category is the UN says, yep, this person meets that criteria for being a well-founded fear of persecution, death, violence in their own country. And then if they come to the United States, we in the United States, we do our own vetting of those people.
We do. So even before they arrive here, and you've probably heard that it takes sometimes 2, 3, 4 years to get through the vetting system, and it is the strictest vetting system you can imagine. It's extreme vetting. After the UNHCR does its vetting, and then the United States takes them through the steps overseas, there are 15 steps after that. And if you answer a question inconsistently about where you might have been on a certain day, irrelevant of any ties to any organizations, they have reason to not include you in the status of refugee. Once they arrive, refugees are then going to go through another few steps. And so the fact is, Monsignor, I'm not sure that you or I could get into this country under the vetting.
Well, you know, I was born in the Bronx, so I'm already attached to the mainland. And as I keep reminding our people, is that the Bronx is the only part of New York City that is connected to the mainland. Every place else is on an island. You have Manhattan Island, you have Staten Island, and even though people don't think about it, Brooklyn and Queens are part of Long Island. And so we in the Bronx, I'm in the country.
You're here.
I don't need a passport. I don't need to cross a bridge. I don't need to do anything. Although you would know this as well as I, a little bit of insider baseball for our listeners in other parts of the country. It certainly takes a while to get up that Hutchinson River Parkway during rush hour near Boston Post Road. So they try to keep us in the Bronx.
We have all sorts of systems,
right.
All sorts of filtering systems.
Right. So Kathy O'Callaghan is the founder, and she is the president. She was founder, along with a lot of other people, of Hearts and Homes for Refugees a few years ago. So tell us about a particular family that you met. Give our listeners a flavor for, you know, one of those 20 families that you have come to know, their story, where they are, what they wound up, what they had to do.
So it's, I can speak to the family that we resettled. It was the first family refugee family in Westchester. And as I said, there have been other groups and organization, interfaith groups, who have all come to the table and have settled refugees. But our family, the Ali Deebs we've spoken to about in the past, came from Syria via Egypt and Turkey. And coincidentally, they were processed or vetted or interviewed many times by the Catholic Charities office in Turkey. And I've since met and become friends with a woman who was in that office who's now living here. Small world story. And they came to us through Catholic Charities when Kelly Agnew-Barjas called and one day said to a group, ours, which had been kind of bubbling and ready to take in refugees, okay, we have a family and it's an emergency situation. They're going to be here in 3 weeks. Can your group handle this? And usually it takes 3 to 6 months to organize all the committees, all the work. And we said yes, and we welcomed them a week before the ban went into effect. And we had housing and at the time, probably 300 to 400 volunteers had signed up during Welcome Refugee Weekend in Pelham. And this family, we descended on this family and for 18 months have helped them acclimate, get into the schools. The kids came here, four of them, from Syria, not speaking a word of English. And within 6 months, by the end of the season, school year, they had learned English. They were on the honor roll and acclimated very well, had friends and done that.
How old were the kids?
2, 5, 11, and 13 at the time.
Wow. So a kind of a nice spread in different grades, one not in school and whatever. And were there mother and father with the family?
Mother and father. Very close, very tight family, wonderful, loving family.
And their religion?
Muslim.
Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Because Syria, while a lot of Muslims, there are also other religions in Syria, too.
Right, they have Christian.
Yeah. And so now, again, to help our listeners get a little feel for this, when a refugee family is approved for to resettle in the United States, they do get some help from the government for a while, don't they?
They do. They have about 3 months of support. There's a certain scholarship or financial aid that is given to each refugee, and they are supported through Catholic Charities and the other resettlement agencies with language and employment and social services for the time that they're allowed to access them.
And there's a little bit of a housing allowance, too, isn't there?
That's included.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, the reality is that's why when you look at where refugees have gone in the United States, you say, well, why is a refugee resettling there? That doesn't seem to be a place. But sometimes it is because the housing allowance doesn't permit them to resettle in places like New York or like California. So you wind up with people in other places where their housing dollar goes quite a bit further.
And we grappled with that when we thought about Westchester County as being a welcoming community. But the fact is, what we offer as in the co-sponsorship community model is longer term support. And by providing 12 to 18 months in addition to what the government does, it's all volunteer. It's all money from individuals, not the government. We're not draining the government. And by the time you pull the support structure away, they're much more able to stand on their own 2 feet from language assimilation, from in the schools, just everything. They're so much better prepared.
And I think that's a very interesting point. And I mean, we work with a lot of programs of government supports, and almost all of them are time limited in the sense that we'll do it for 3 months, we'll do it for a year, we'll do it for 2 years. And that's really understandable because there are limited resources and you have to make decisions about how long. However, what I think you point out is that sometimes you can save a lot of money in the long term if you spend a little bit more upfront, because there is, if the foundation's a little bit stronger, the long term outcome is going to be a lot stronger too.
That's exactly right. And when you expose a Muslim family or a Christian family or someone who comes to this country with no language skills and no network, we are used to networks in this country. What happens is they assimilate so much better. In our in Westchester County, we've got over 2,000 people directly involved, either in co-sponsorship or advocating for refugees, and they come from all faith groups, all community sizes. We have, you know, so many different groups involved. And think about what that means for the refugees that are exposed to this kind of openness and this kind of welcome.
So what is, was this in working with these refugees, these families, was there something that maybe surprised you a little bit about refugees?
I think that it was that they are just like us. I mean, this family is just like my family. I have four kids. They have needs. They have experiences that are, yes, different, but they have the same family connection, and that is central to their lives. You know, I think that we weren't prepared for feeling so alike. And I think that resettlement has wrinkles that you can't understand until you've been in the middle of it. Like, it's not always so easy for them, for us, and that there were surprises.
And
what kinds of surprises?
Yeah.
I think that this family in some ways was not as ready to venture out as we would have hoped in our time frame. So you have to put aside your time frame, your expectations, your predisposed ideas about what you would do in the same situation. And that works out much better when you do that.
One of the things that I think is that a little bit of my experience is, particularly with immigrants and with refugees, is that there is a tremendous amount of industriousness. There's a tremendous amount of self-sufficiency, of self-starting, and that while oftentimes refugees and immigrants have come from very difficult situations, there's been a lot of trouble, sometimes oppression, a lot of poverty, sometimes. The other part of the reality is that these are individuals who have decided they're going to make their life better, and that they are willing to, they have a lot of energy, they have a lot of self-starting, a lot of industriousness, and there's a lot of strengths that they bring. It's not always that they're downtrodden and in bad places. They sometimes have a lot that they bring to the table.
They do. And if you look at the numbers, many people don't know this, but the contributions economically that migrants and that immigrants and refugees have made to the economy are really quite startling. So to your point, they are hardworking. They have to survive. We're all survivors, and this is what they're doing. Our family started, very good at cooking, started a catering and cooking business.
And that is wonderful. Did they actually do something? Did they actually put on an event?
Oh, several events. We have many groups throughout Westchester County that would hire them to, for their synagogue meeting or for their interfaith group and have them come and speak. So, you know, food is always the great coordinator. And we see that today in a lot of the events that are taking place this month through Welcoming Week in Westchester County. It's a national event organized by Welcoming America to bring immigrants and refugees and people who are born here together. And there are many events, and many of them are, you know, prayer and interfaith meetings, but also centered around cooking and cooking demonstrations and meals. So
Kathy, if your group has done some really great stuff right outside of New York City, and I'm sure there are a couple of things. One, I'm sure there are groups in other cities and other places who are doing similar things. But I also bet there are some people listening today who say, gee, you know, I'd like to do something. Gee, that's really interesting. I've always wanted to do something. What would your advice be to those people? Is there a way they can get help to organize, to kind of do things in their own communities?
One of the things we've been doing is to talk to other people, individuals who come to us and say, what can I do? And we are happy to have those conversations. We have a website. It is undergoing renovation, but we also have plenty of experience and are willing to talk to people.
What's the website? Because someday it'll get up. The construction will be over.
Well, it's there. A lot of information. It's www.org. heartsandhomesforrefugees.org, all one word.
So, Kathy, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love. I think we got a real sense about how neighbors can welcome new neighbors, even if the new neighbor's neighborhood was thousands of miles away. They become new neighbors and they become part of our community. And so thank you for the work that you are doing and that you continue to do. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kathy O'Callaghan, who is the president, the founder of Hearts and Homes for Refugees, a group that has welcomed already 60 refugees outside of New York City and helping them to kind of become part of their new home in the United States. So we are talking about refugees, talking about volunteers. This is the week in which we celebrated September 11th. Probably a better word is marked or commemorated. It was such an awful event that we don't celebrate it, but we mark it and we hope that we can kind of move forward and do things in a way that is better. And volunteering is one of the fruits of that that has happened. So thank you for joining us today. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is the week of 9/11. That awful day in which thousands of people lost their lives in only an hour or so. And it is a terrible, terrible memory that we all have. Things have changed in so many ways since that day. The security at airports and in buildings is just so different than it was prior to that. On the positive side, there's a lot of people mocking 9/11 by volunteering. I know that I worked with a group that packs foods for food kitchens and for soup kitchens and food pantries. And so there's a lot of good that has come out of that, but no mistaking the fact that it was a horrendous, awful event in which thousands of people lost their lives. So, Fanny, let's do some news now. So, you know. So tell us about girls getting into a cat fight.
So before I get to that, I think that our listeners need a little bit of background.
Okay.
Because this has been going on for about a year. It wasn't just...
So who are we talking about?
We're talking about Cardi B and Nicki Minaj.
Okay. Cardi, so, and remember, for those of you in the rest of the country, it's a Bronx-Queens thing. So
yes.
That's like a New York City kind of neighborhood neighborhood fight going on. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So about last year, apparently, Nicki Minaj wrote a lyric about... Offset, who is Cardi B's husband.
Okay.
Then after that, she apparently wrote another lyric about Cardi B. She denies these things.
Right.
But then Cardi B and Nicki Minaj were on a song together called Motorsport.
Okay.
Nicki felt as though Cardi should have been more appreciative that she let her be on her song.
Ah.
And Cardi's attitude was basically like, you know, I am thankful, but what else do you want me to say? You know, after that, there's been, you know, some animosity back and forth. The last thing that happened and what caused last weekend's fight was because Cardi claims that Nicki Minaj was talking about her parenting skills. Cardi has a 2-month-old, 3-month-old daughter with Offset. And Cardi got really mad and really upset, saw her at the Harper's Bazaar Icon party at Fashion Week, New York Fashion Week, and just launched herself on Nicki Minaj.
She actually physically, like...
She literally ran to her. I think there were 3 men holding her back. At the end of it, Cardi's dress was ripped open. She had a very, on her face, it was this huge bump on her face. Someone smacked her, hit her with their elbow by mistake, while trying to get her away from Nicki Minaj. So it's all on video. TMZ has it. But yeah, it's a 1-year rivalry. This is not uncommon for Nicki Minaj.
She gets into this a lot.
She talks a lot of crap, for lack of a better word. She talks a lot about... She has things going on with Mariah Carey, things going on with Lil' Kim. It's been... This doesn't surprise me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't surprise. Did somebody throw a shoe?
Yeah. Well, that's... Cardi B is known to throw shoes. She's done it before on television. That didn't surprise me either.
So here's the real question.
Okay.
Fanny. The real question is, all staged for publicity?
I don't think so.
You think
not
this
on
is
Cardi's
real?
Part? Okay. Maybe on Nicki's part.
Okay.
Cardi doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah, Cardi can throw shoes even if she's not famous.
Okay.
I've seen her do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever met either of them in person?
No, I haven't. Okay. I would like to meet Cardi, though. She seems like a lot of fun.
Okay. All right. So anyway, you say, why are we talking about this? We're talking about this because the reality is that this is what so much of our world pays attention to.
Right.
And so is there a lesson in there? Well, part of the lesson maybe is that it's a little bit of a shame, I think, that things like this do dominate the news.
Yeah.
And you can't avoid it. And, you know, clearly, I would suggest that behavior, while maybe it's a little bit humorous and maybe it's a little bit entertaining, it kind of isn't the way that we should be treating each other. It's not really the way that we should be trying to deal with each other. And that's why in all of these things, I always kind of wonder if some of it isn't a little bit staged because, you know what they say, there's no such thing as bad publicity. As long as your name is in the news, you sell more records, you're there. But anyway, but I also think the reason why it's important to pay attention to these things because these are the people that a lot of our young people are following, paying attention to, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's an important thing for us to recognize that and there's a lot going on. So anyway, yeah. All right. So thanks for bringing it up today. Now, what about, and I'm going to be biased in what I say next, what about, in my judgment, one of, if not, the greatest athlete of all time? What'd she do last weekend?
She, so,
and for those in the those who think I'm talking about Babe Ruth, I'm not. and I'm certainly not talking about Tom Brady. But who are we talking about?
We are talking about Serena Williams.
Okay.
So she played at the U.S. Open with 20-year-old Naomi Osaka, and she lost to her, which I think was the news.
Right.
But no one's paying attention to that.
Right.
Because of Serena's actions. So she was fined a total of $17,000 for 3 code violations. The tournament's refugees office Sunday docked Williams $10,000 for verbal abuse of the umpire. His name was Carlos Ramos. $4,000 for being warned for coaching, and $3,000 for breaking her racket. So the company comes out, the money comes out of her prize money, which is $1.85 million as runner up. It's very sad, my opinion.
Okay.
It's, you know, she came out and said that it's unfair because if men act this way during a tournament, no one bats an eye. But because she's a woman and a woman of color, she gets fined and she lost a point and then she lost the tournament. In my opinion, no one should be acting that way, men or women. And it's a shame that this is what's taking over the news when a 20-year-old won over Serena Williams. Like, I think that is the news. And this poor girl had to be overshadowed by her actions. And I think that is tremendously sad and annoying. And I think that it's ridiculous that the media is kind of taking Serena's side when it's like, come on, you're an athlete. This is what you do for a living. You're paid to do this. You're Serena Williams anyway, whether or not you lost. I think that she should just get over it, in my opinion. Okay. I'm sorry, world.
No, that's good. But isn't there another piece to it? Didn't the fans boo?
Yes.
What was that about?
So the fans started booing. They actually, when the referee, he had to walk out. He was supposed to hand over the trophy to the winner, and he didn't.
The referee is supposed
yes.
to do that?
The ump, Carlos Ramos. He was supposed to, and he didn't. He walked out. They were booing him out. And Serena actually said, oh, don't boo. Let's right. not boo. Let's not take this moment away from Naomi. But yeah. at that point, it was, in my opinion, it was already taken away from her. You know, it was kind of like the Kanye West and Beyonce and Taylor Swift thing when Kanye went up on stage and said, you know, hold on, Taylor, Beyonce had the best video of all right. time. It didn't matter that Beyonce kind of gave a moment to Taylor at the end because Kanye had already ruined it. And
right.
that was the news. It wasn't Taylor winning best video. So, yeah. you know, it's a really sad situation.
So it's interesting. And I do think there's a lot to this story.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact we're talking about it is indicates that there's a lot to the story. The piece that I really liked
mm-hmm.
was Serena saying to the crowd, hey, give her a moment,
yeah.
don't boo, stuff like that. You know, some things you can't control. Once you do it, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I have no opinion on whether or not there's an accuracy to her claim that she was penalized and a white man would
right.
not have been. Don't know whether that's the case at all. The other thing which I would say is within limits, you know, we expect when a call goes against you to blame it on the ref. So
mm-hmm.
they gotta be a little bit bigger too. I mean, in mm-hmm. terms of, yeah, you know, it's that. But the piece I don't get, the piece which I find a little bit troubling. Of all of this, the piece that's most troubling is the coaching from the stands.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, if that's not allowed, which apparently it isn't.
Yeah.
Well, hey, stop it.
Yeah.
I mean, and apparently, again, if you read the story right, mm-hmm. well, I blame the coach for coaching. And not so much, I mean, it was claimed that she didn't even see him or mm-hmm. see the coach. But I mean, that just strikes me as whatever. That's like just not.
Yeah. Right. Well, my friends who saw the entire game said that he did kind of give her some type of sign right. during the game, and she nodded at him.
Okay.
So she confirmed whatever it was that he said to her.
Right.
He also said that later on, like a day or so later, the coach confirmed that he was coaching her.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's.
Yeah.
It's bad all around. It's just. It's, yeah. Yeah.
No, but didn't the same player, didn't she beat Serena last year someplace?
Did she? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure about that. I don't know about that. But the other thing, which is very interesting, because and talking about refugees and things mm-hmm. things like that, mm-hmm. apparently she is both Haitian and Japanese.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, I think her father, who is Haitian, mm-hmm. kind of pushed to have her identified as being Japanese.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yep, yep. And so it's a kind of an interesting piece to that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I guess the takeaway for me on all of this is we are fascinated with celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
We're fascinated with when they do good things, when they do bad things, and they become the talk of the town. So whether it be Cardi B and Nicki Minaj getting into it, whether it's Serena throwing a little bit of a temper tantrum, justified, not justified, who knows. But it does seem to me that these provide us with good opportunities to reflect upon how we should act and what's appropriate and not. And sometimes we learn a lot from bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We say, ooh, that's not the way we should act. That's not the way that people should act. And I hope that kind of parents can use that as a teaching moment for their kids to say, hey, wonderful athlete, but nah, not that. Good entertainer, but nah, that's not the way
right.
we do it. So anyway, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to speak about the United Nations and the great work that they do. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And we talk about those things that we hope make our world more just and more compassionate. But we also say that even if we're not dealing with those broad international, national issues, we can all make our world more just and more compassionate if we simply love ourselves, love our neighbor, love God, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Well, this is the time of the year when the United Nations reconvenes. And so I'm delighted that we have as our guest from the International Peace Institute, who is a senior fellow there, Alexandra Novoselov, and I may not have gotten that name right, and I hope that she will correct me when I'm wrong, who is going to speak to us about some of the things going on in the United Nations. Dr. Novoselov, thank you for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
How wrong did I get the pronunciation of your name?
Not at all.
Okay. Well, you're very kind, and thank you so much. So tell us, our listeners, a little bit, that this time of the year, the General Assembly comes together, and there's a big meeting. And for those of us in New York, it's a nightmare for traffic because of everybody coming to town. But on a serious level, what is the United Nations grappling with? What does it try to do? And we'll get, you know, generically that. And what does the Security Council in particular do?
Well, you know, the United Nations is part of our daily lives. We often don't realize it, but if we can send mail to the other end of the world, it's because there's an agreement that have been signed for that. If there's if we can fly over the world, that's also because of agreements that have been made between states, and the UN was there to facilitate those. And that I can continue for many aspects of our lives, health, the environment. When it comes to the Security Council is the highest body that can decide on peace and war.
And yes. So this year in 1918, in September, what will be the top issues that the Security Council will be dealing with in terms of preventing war throughout the world?
Well, this year, I mean, it depends on various crises. You know, the so the opening of the next session of the General Assembly is a huge diplomatic momentum, and usually the Council, I mean, is meeting or can meet, but usually it's not. It's not what happens because there's so many other meetings. But on a daily basis, every day, the Council is looking at various crises, such as the crisis in Yemen, the crisis in Syria, crisis in Africa, that people don't really talk about. The Council is still dealing with what is happening in Haiti, with Kosovo. So there are many crises that are not on the top agenda of or on the top headlines of our newspapers. But the Council is working every day to try to find a solution to those crises. But of course, I mean, when I talk about the council, it looks like, you know, it's one thing that operates in itself, which is not the case, of course. It's an organ of 15 member states with five member states that are a bit more powerful than the others because they have, in particular, the right of veto, but also they have the permanency of you know, sitting in the council. So the decisions that the council is making, that the council is making, it's the result of compromises, of negotiations, of diplomatic negotiations among 15 member states.
So, Doc,
and the level of the consensus inside depends is key to the result in the end.
So, Dr. Novoselov, you have studied a lot of this stuff for a while. From your perspective, in doing work that tries to make our world more peaceful, what would you think are the three world situations right now that should merit the attention of the United Nations? Because, in your professional judgment, these are critical areas which could further seriously threaten world peace.
I mean, I think that there's no crisis at the moment that hasn't not been put on the table of the council. Look at Burma and the situation of the Rohingyas. The council had a big meeting two weeks ago on that. Syria is also on the table of the council. But of course, Russia and to a lesser extent China are, refusing to put to make decisions on that. So I think that the issue is not whether the council is looking at crisis or not, but what is it able to achieve on those crises? And of course, that depends on the involvement. Each crisis, it depends on the involvement of a permanent member or not. And when there's no consensus, like it is the case now, for 5 years or more now, on Syria, then the council is unable to adopt adopt a resolution and to advance a peace process.
So, Dr. Novoselov, you've outlined very clearly that major issues have been on the agenda of the Security Council. From your perspective, what are the maybe one or two critical danger points that you see at this time that could really negatively impact world peace? What are the things that keep you up at night saying, gee, if that's a real crisis, this is a potential real crisis?
I mean, I think that what is the rhetoric around Iran is, for me, is very dangerous. I think the way your government in particular is building the case against Iran is very dangerous and is potentially a serious threat to international peace and security. The way all the regional powers are behaving in this region are also a threat to international peace and security, in my view. So this is and unfortunately, in this case, there's little that the council can do because it's blocked. But at least my hope is that when the U.S. government puts a case against Iran in the council, there will be other countries, just like what happened in the Iraq war in 2003, that will say, sorry, but we don't believe you. And the UN will not follow that. Okay. And the fact that in during the Iraq crisis, the Iraq war, the UN did not follow what the US and the UK wanted to do, you know, I think increased the credibility of the UN and not the reverse.
So, Dr. Novoselov, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. And you've made me and you've made our audience a little bit more knowledgeable about world affairs and the United Nations and some of the threats that we face. So thank you for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Thank you very much.
This is Just Love. Do it. God, neighbor, self, and our world will be a little bit more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
You're listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.